Bienvenue à It's All Politics from NPR News. Je m'appelle Ron Elving.
Yeah, and I'm Ken Rutan.
And this is the special edition of It's All Politics for Bastille Day 2011. And we're also celebrating the victory of the U.S. women's soccer team over the French.
Let's have a French toast.
You are a total American, as always.
I am.
And I want to salute you as that, because we are the greatest country in the world, as is demonstrated by the way we settle disputes between our major political parties. We know what's important. What's important is that the United States always honor its obligations and always pay its debts.
Till debt do us part.
Until August 2nd. And as we have heard from a number of our presidential candidates this week, debt ceiling, schmet ceiling. We don't have to pay these debts.
Who do they think they are? Barack Obama when he was a senator?
That's exactly right.
Oh,
but you know what the difference? You know what the difference is?
He's a Democrat?
There is no difference. He, when he was running for president, didn't want to vote for raising the debt ceiling.
How come?
Because he wanted to use that opportunity to thwack George W. Bush for a series of tax cuts that, if you took them away, would wipe out a quarter of the deficit problem we're facing now, and a $1 trillion war in Iraq, and a $1 trillion war in Afghanistan, none of which was financed, along with the Part D Medicare addition of prescription drugs, none of which was financed. And so in protest of that, he cast a protest vote, knowing full well that there was no question the debt ceiling would
be raised. I think
we
both agree. And the situation is different today.
And the situation is a little different. And I think a lot of responsible Republicans who normally would vote against raising the debt ceiling may, in the end, vote to raise the debt ceiling in this instance, for the same reason, that it does come around to being a different situation and it is important. But traditionally, the out party, that is not the majority, and the Democrats were not the majority in 2006, does not vote to raise the debt ceiling, and the party that is in the majority does. One of the things that's made this situation different from the previous 89 times the debt ceiling has been raised since 1939 is that the party that is in the majority doesn't want to step up to the plate and do it.
You did mention Republicans who might want to support a vote to raise the debt limit. There was John Boehner, Speaker of the House, for a brief shining moment. He was talking about, look, we'll make concessions and you make concessions and we'll have $4 trillion in savings.
Yeah, and you
which
know
is what?
What
the Republicans ostensibly want.
Well, no. I think what the Republicans ostensibly want is no new taxes and no tax revenue increases. And that is their number one agenda item, and it is now clear it is their only agenda item. Everything else that they have ever talked about wanting
That's
to do...
That's why I said ostensible, by the way.
So everything else that they've talked about over the years and everything else that has been a big Republican issue over the years seems now to be set aside in preference for the no tax.
And if we're talking about political fallout, once upon a time, not too long ago, it seemed like the Republicans had the upper hand. First of all, Obama and the Democrats were fighting each other. He was talking about putting Social Security and Medicare on the table. The left, or the progressive wing of the party, was up in arms, and the Republicans could sit back and say, hey, we have them on the ropes. And now it seems the Republicans are more fractured than ever. And if anything, if polls indicate that if a default does happen or we go to August 2nd with no agreement, it's the GOP that takes the blame.
I'm not sure. That would seem to be the rational summary, and I think that the way you laid it out just
assuming anything is rational in this.
Exactly.
Well, yeah.
Exactly. And I think what you just said made a lot of sense. But I also think that in the end, the Republicans do still have very much the upper hand. The economy is Barack Obama's responsibility at this juncture. And if it is badly damaged by these debt negotiations, if in fact, and we already know that Moody's rating service is holding in abeyance the further AAA rating of U.S. debt. This has always been the gold standard of debt, but of course, we went off the gold standard long ago.
I always thought the AAA rating was in Libya.
Actually, I think the AAA rating is for
that's
car.
That's the AAA rating. I'm so sorry.
The fate of America hangs in the balance, or at least the markets for stocks and bonds and for commodities and for many other things are going to be severely affected if, in fact, no deal can be reached.
But if you ask some Republicans, like, say, Michelle Bachmann, they say that's not true.
Scare tactics.
Why? Louis Gohmert said that, too, the congressman from Texas, saying your problem, the Republicans' problem, Mitch McConnell's problem, is that he listens to President Obama, and basically he's calling the President of the United States a liar because, obviously, they're manufacturing this crisis, manufacturing the scare tactics. You know, the sky's going to fall. Says who? Michelle Bachmann says, prove it. You know, we don't know for sure if it's going to happen. So
Ron Paul says something similar.
Yeah.
Although Ron Paul does sort of say the sky is going to fall, but Ron Paul says, fine, let it.
Yeah.
it's time we did that. Sky's going to fall someday, so let's do it now. It'll be worse if we let it fall a generation from now. And that's a little bit, it seems to me, more realistic and more honest on Ron Paul's part to say, yes, there are going to be dire consequences, and they're going to happen very soon, but that should happen. We should have the dire consequences now, as opposed to saying there simply are no consequences.
Whereas Rachel Bachman and others have said that, you know, Tim Geithner says August 2nd is the deadline, says who, you know? And so there's so much distrust with what may be established fact in this country. We saw that with the birther argument. We see it with the climate change argument. There may be proof out there or substantial evidence that something is true, but just because one side says it, the other side just doesn't believe it. Maybe that's the reason one side doesn't believe it.
One thing that rather amazes me is that you have a great deal of consensus among business people. Wall Street, yes, but not just Wall Street, also Main Street businesses, bankers.
Which is often Republican.
Investors, most of whom I would argue are Republican, and who are going to the Republican leadership in Congress, House and Senate, and saying, this, you know, actually does matter. You cannot default on the U.S. debt without there being, among other consequences, and I'm not saying that every building in America is going to fall down overnight. The consequences are in terms of what it will cost us to borrow money in the future.
But you just said something interesting. You used the term Republican leadership. Is the Republican leadership John Boehner in the House and Mitch McConnell in the Senate?
If there is leadership, yes, because there is no alternative.
Well, the alternative may be Eric Cantor in the House and Jim DeMint in the Senate.
All right. Let's say Eric Cantor is the real de facto leader of the House Republican majority at this moment. His title is majority leader. Of course, there's a speaker who is supposed to be his superior, but he's clearly not ceding to him anymore. He's not taking a back seat to him anymore.
Cantor is not taking a back seat to him.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So is Eric Cantor then the leader of the House Republican majority? I'm not sure he can deliver the majority to a deal that he agrees to either.
No, but he's saying there is no deal because we can't get a vote. We won't get a vote in the House. We're not going to vote for anything that includes, quote, higher taxes.
In what sense, then, are you a representative in the United States House of Representatives who is supposed to be in the leadership if you cannot deliver any kind of a vote from your members?
Cannot or will not.
Well, cannot? Boehner, he says he cannot.
When Boehner was sitting at the table,
I think he doesn't want to try.
Well, that's exactly right. When Boehner was sitting at the table with Obama, it seems like he wanted to get something done for both sides. Both sides needed to come away with a deal to show that both sides could accomplish something. Cantor, and I suspect perhaps a majority of the Republican caucus, feels that that may not be the best interest of the Republican Party.
So there is one possibility, which is that they want no deal, no matter what's in the deal. That if the president came forward and said, I'll give you $4 trillion in spending cuts over 10 years, and there will be no new tax revenues in this plan, that they would then have another condition. They would say, plus we want a balanced budget
amendment.
They
would agree to that deal, and then there would be a mutiny on the Democratic side.
Well, you would think they would agree to that deal, but you would think they would have agreed to 4-to-1 ratio.
Yeah, right.
You would have thought that they would have agreed to a real offer of something that would have been 80-90% of everything Republicans have been fighting for since Ronald Reagan in 1980. And by the way, in Ronald Reagan's 8 years, when I first came to Washington, the debt ceiling was lifted on a bipartisan basis 18 times.
And how many times did the Republican Party, or at least the Reagan White House, push for higher taxes?
At least two or three times.
Yes, right.
Two or three times. Not hugely higher, certainly not relative to the terms we use today, but they were willing to compromise on pretty much the whole fiscal range of issues after they got the basics of what they wanted. That was what was important to them. Win on the big stuff. Get the basics, move the country in the direction you want to go, but don't turn down a deal that's in your favor just because it isn't 100% of what you want.
Well, we keep talking on this podcast about the different philosophies of government, and that seems to be the philosophy that is taking place in Washington, that we're just not going to back down. We signed a pledge. Grover Norquist made us sign the pledge, whatever, but we signed the pledge. We campaigned on it. And I'm not being sarcastic here because we know what happened to George H.W. Bush in 1992 after he reneged on his No Read My Lips pledge. And I think Republicans say, look, we are not politics as usual. We represent what the people want, and the people expect us to keep our word.
That's right. And in a point of accuracy, we're not talking about all Republicans here either, because there are many Republicans who see this much as the Republicans did in the 1980s, by and large. Get what you can get most of what's out there, push your agenda forward.
That was Ronald Reagan to a T.
To a T. And there are still many who would see it the same way as he did, as George H.W. Bush did, and as, to some degree, George W. Bush did on some issues, although he was usually getting most all of what he wanted. What is different here is that a faction within the Republican Party, we loosely call it the Tea Party faction, and many of them are associated or directly tied to the Tea Party, but many of them are just, if you will, sympathizer, empathizer Tea Party people, are saying, no more deals. And we want to see what happens if you drive the car off the cliff. We literally want to see what happens if you Thelma and Louise it out into the ether.
Well, as I recall, there was no sequel to Thelma and Louise, and then I wonder what the sequel would be if that does happen.
Yeah, well, the actresses were available, but the characters, unfortunately, were not.
No. And yet, when we talk about the absolutism of some Republicans on the debt ceiling, I expected to see that in Iowa on the same-sex petition, the thing that Bob Vanderplas in Iowa is proposing, that you sign this thing that absolutely no same-sex marriage at all.
Social conservative values across a number of issues, right? Abortion, same-sex marriage, school prayer.
Initially, there was some language in it that said that slave families
had
better family structure than today's African-American families. That language had been stripped, but Michelle Bachmann did sign that. But interesting, Tim Pawlenty, we keep talking about Tim Pawlenty, and I'd like to talk about Tim Pawlenty in a bit, because when you think of defaulting, you think of what he did in Minnesota, but also he may default on his presidential candidacy because he... Anyway,
if you want to talk about Tim, you probably better hurry.
You think of all the things that Tim Pawlenty did right in trying to establish himself as the anti-Mitt Romney.
Well, more conservative than Mitt.
And, you know, siding up to evangelicals in Iowa, spending a lot of time in Iowa thinking that would make or break his candidacy. And yet... He has not done well in the polls, but I thought it was interesting that this week that this anti-same-sex marriage petition that Bob Vanderplas, the conservative former state legislator...
Social activist in Iowa.
...is pushing through, Pawlenty wouldn't sign it. Now, Romney didn't sign it either, but Pawlenty would not.
I think most of the candidates have not
I think that's true. Michelle Bachmann has...
She's making sure she keeps those people.
And she's also, you know, doing very, very well in Iowa.
She's ahead in the polls there now.
Now, again, we are talking about next February, but I think just as we're talking about how the United States is so closely watching the August 2nd debt ceiling limit date, I think many Republican candidates are looking at the August 13th Ames straw poll.
That's another drop-dead deadline.
Which in the past, it was drop-dead for people like Lamar Alexander, Elizabeth Dole, Dan Quayle in previous cycles where their expectations just never materialized.
No, Orrin Hatch, that whole juggernaut just came across.
No, he lasted at least until the actual caucus.
Yeah, but I think he finished dead last in the straw poll.
I think he finished ninth in a field of eight. Yes,
something like that. And in August of 99, hey, those were the days, huh?
No, they were. By the way, there is a difference, Ron Elving. I don't know if you know this. There is a difference between the August 2nd debt ceiling limit and the August 13th straw poll. But
11 days.
But there seems to be... Tim Pawlenty is in a situation where he cannot win. Remember when he went easy on Mitt Romney and Romney cared during the debate area? He said he was a wuss and and then he said, you know, he wasn't strong enough and he was weak. And now that now he realizes that everybody expects him to be more combative. And so he's going after Michelle Bachmann, saying that she has a non-existent record in Congress. I mean, if you're a Michelle Bachmann fan, criticizing her or inability to get something through in Congress is not going to be a criticism that sticks.
No, and he is really kind of desperately flailing in this situation because he was counting on being the Minnesotan coming down across the border and being the local guy in the Iowa caucuses.
Backed by social conservatives and Tea Party folks.
You know, and he was expecting to have sort of the Bob Dole effect when he did well in Iowa because he was from a nearby state and that helping him in Iowa. He was hoping for that kind of dynamic. It helped Walter Mondale when he came down from Minnesota. When he came down from whatever planet he had come from.
The planet Mondale.
And that dynamic was supposed to be a big part of why he thought he could do to Mitt Romney what Mike Huckabee did to Mitt Romney there in Iowa in 2008. Surprise him, come from nowhere. This is not working for Tim, and it's not working because of Michelle Bachmann. He's got other problems. He's not raising a lot of money, but that's a problem for the whole Republican field.
And, except for Mitt Romney.
Well, even Mitt Romney. You know, Mitt Romney raised $18 million, more than half of it in one big push event. Now, he's got to get out there and start doing more of those events. By this point in 2007, two different Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, had already raised $25 million and $30-some million at this point. Mitt Romney should be doing better as the Republican front runner with Republican money out there. He should be able to do better than $18 million in the first 6 months.
Let me just go back to your comparison of 2007, which is very important. In 2007, the Republican name was not doing well. The Democrats were on the ascendancy. You'd figure that the Democrats would be raising all this money because there was so much anger against President Bush and the Republicans. In 2011, one would think that there's anger against President Obama and there'd be a lot of enthusiasm among the Republicans.
Absolutely.
But you're not getting it on the Republican side. And my goodness, look at what President Obama and the DNC raised.
$86 million.
$47 million going to his campaign, the rest going to the DNC. That's a lot of money. I mean, that's not a surprise.
It's not a surprise with an incumbent president. George W. Bush did extraordinarily well, too.
We also expect this to approach $1 billion in 2012.
And they've set that as a goal. Yeah. So, of course, they're going to have raised a lot in the first 6 months. I think, though, the comparison to George W. Bush is an apt one. There were a lot of questions about Bush in 2003, 2004. The Iraq War was not going well. There were a lot of people who were unhappy with him, even in the Republican Party. Not enough to challenge him, of course. But there was a sense the Democrats had a shot in 2004. W. Bush came out, raised a lot of money, had no trouble at all raising money, and that helped turn around some the perception of his political vulnerability and helped him win eventually a fairly close race in November of 2004. The Republicans need to get behind a champion fairly soon or they're going to wind up in a situation where they've got a Dole-like candidate or a John Kerry-like candidate who is not seen on the same level of party unity and party rally.
John McCain.
Or even John McCain, although I think in the end John McCain was the right candidate in 2008. He was completely done in by the financial collapse of September 2008. He was ahead in the polls, even with Sarah Palin as a kind of question.
Not even with that. Sarah Palin was helping until
her debate with Joe Biden and with Katy Couric. And she was probably a net plus as of September 15th in 2008. Right. I still think John McCain could have won that race on his own with another vice presidential candidate because the country was not sold on Barack Obama until the financial collapse and until McCain's own campaign collapsed trying to respond to that financial collapse.
But what I'm doing is I'm going back to 4 years ago at this time, and even though that, you know, Mitt Romney, first of all, Mitt Romney had the most money, and I remember looking at a poll in New Hampshire where I think McCain was fifth. I think it was like Romney, Giuliani, Fred Thompson, and then McCain fourth or fifth.
In New Hampshire. And where he eventually won.
Exactly, won handily, and 38% of the Republicans there said they would never vote for him. The only reason I'm saying that is because here we are once again, the Republicans trying to get some kind of momentum or some kind of put themselves in some kind of position where they can effectively challenge President Obama. And we're still talking about the what-ifs, and the latest what-if seems to be Rick Perry.
Rick Perry is the governor of Texas. He has been in that office longer than anyone else in history.
He's been there more than a decade. He's also the longest current serving governor in the country.
At the same time, the governorship of Texas is an unusual governorship.
Not the strongest.
It does not have the strong position of power that title usually conveys in most states.
That's why no governor of Texas has ever been elected president.
Well, of course, we know that's not true. But the only one who has, George W. Bush, did not exactly leave the White House in clouds of glory. In fact, there's a new poll out this week from Quinnipiac saying that more people blame George W. Bush for the economy, even today in 2011.
I think those are people in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, but more people blame Bush for where we are financially in this country than blame Barack Obama, which is surprising because people usually blame the current president. There's an argument.
Especially over 2 years into a presidency.
That's right. Exactly. Now, there's an argument to be made that, you know, it's all Bush's fault. Sure, and I've made it myself. But there usually, by 2 years into a presidency, has been a major shift to thinking that the current president is in charge and is responsible. And certainly a lot of people are arguing that. So I would argue the last thing the Republicans want is a candidate who, while he isn't George W. Bush, may remind way too many people of George W. Bush and, frankly, has some of the same flaws, has some of the same anti-intellectuality about him, the same sort of lack of curiosity and non-analytical kind of personality.
That's the problem. I mean, you keep thinking that this is a great opportunity for the Republicans. The Obama reelect numbers are not great. But to this day, and even though we keep saying that Mitt Romney is the ostensible frontrunner, the thing is, again, I know every time I mention Fred Thompson, you get upset because you think I'm teasing you.
And you are.
I am not. But the point is, I just wonder if Rick Perry, and he seems to be giving all the signals that he's going to run. I still don't, honestly, I just don't know what he's going to do. But he's meeting with all the fundraisers. He's on the phone with fundraisers all the time.
He's calling Senator Grassley in Iowa. Should I run in Iowa?
Right, exactly. But I just remember that, you know, Fred Thompson, who was so, everybody was so excited about it, he was going to make a big difference. Once he got in, he didn't do anything. And
he didn't want to do it. His wife wanted to do it. A lot of people around him wanted to do it. And Fred Thompson did not want to do it and never really put any effort into it.
Well, see, that's one difference, I think, between Rick Perry and Mitch Daniels, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Daniels' family was clearly split. The whole Perry family seems to say, we want to do this.
Yeah, I think the Perry family is ready for it. I'm not sure Rick Perry is sure he's ready for it. And that's partly what's holding him back. Although the word is, he's just waiting to see if he can raise the money.
Well, he has a history of raising a ton of money, but it's different raising money in bulk in Texas and then limiting it to $2,500 or $5,000 for a presidential race, which federal laws require.
Yes, there are still some rules, although it's not clear they're going to be all that operative next year. Rick Perry needs to play by those rules in the primaries for the moment, and so he needs to worry about whether or not he's got the dough to make a legitimate run. Other names that are still being mentioned, Rudy Giuliani from New York.
Explain that to me.
Well, he's in New Hampshire. As we speak, he is in New Hampshire shaking hands, meeting people, going to little events. I don't know why he is not running for president. No one thinks really that he is, but his name keeps coming up.
He keeps saying that, hey, I'm close to making a decision. Who's waiting for a Rudy Giuliani decision?
Well, some people are waiting for a Sarah Palin decision, and she is on the cover of Newsweek this week, and that used to mean something. And she is saying that she will decide by late August or early September. What does that sound like to you, Ken?
Sounds like she's not going to decide until like late August or early September.
Which sounds to me as though she decided a long time ago that she's not running in 2012. There's a lot of buzz about how she's terribly upset that Michelle Bachmann has occupied her lane and is doing so well in it, and that that's making her regret her decision not to run. But I, at this point, it appears to me she's still not running.
No, I agree with that completely. And one person who is still in the running for the presidency but is no longer running in the running for his House seat, Ron Paul of Texas.
How long before Michelle Bachmann makes the same decision?
No, Michelle Bachmann stays in the race. She's not going to disappear. Look, Ron Paul is 75 years old. I think he's done whatever he wants to do.
Yeah, but she's serious about running for president. She doesn't want to run for the House again.
Yeah, but remember Dick Gephardt, all the times he ran for president, never gave up his House seat just in case.
Until the last time. He gave it up the last time he ran.
Okay, so Ron Paul is leaving Congress. One person who's coming in is Janice Hahn. She won that special election in California 36, the one that Jane Harmon gave up.
We talked about that.
It was within 9-10 points, and that was closer than most people thought, but the Republicans, Craig Huey and his, you know.
And his brothers.
Exactly. Joyce Brothers and
Almond Brothers.
But before we leave the podcast, again, I just want to, you know, we always talk about whether we always want to leave the podcast on a sad note. And, you know, you think Betty Ford, 93 years old, you know, sad. But you know, there's something about Betty Ford that brings a smile to my face every time I think about her. She was, I mean, you know, it was very unusual to see a first lady that outspoken. And, of course, everything between her breast cancer and her substance abuse and her affinity for Equal Rights Amendment. These were not the kind of words you hear from a first lady, let alone a Republican first lady. And she was a breath of fresh air, especially at a time when we were just coming out of the nightmare of Watergate, and it was just so disturbing.
All true. And it's amazing that given all the controversial things you just mentioned that are associated with her name, she herself was never really controversial. That's not a word that comes to my mind when I think of Betty Ford. We might say that she was groundbreaking. We might say that she was brave-hearted, that she was always gracious. But you wouldn't say the controversial Betty Ford.
No, I think some conservatives felt she was going much too far, and I think they really felt that she was overstepping what she should be saying.
But never as a personality. As a personality, she was the antithesis of controversy. And she was, in fact, this is why I remember her with a great deal of nostalgia, really. She was emblematic of another era in which people could differ. People could even talk about controversial things, take controversial stands, and yet the overall atmosphere, the mood of the personal interchange was entirely different and, I would say, far more humane and far preferable.
Oh, I agree completely. I just remember the 1976 campaign. Well, you know, I don't know much about campaign buttons, but I do remember the buttons that said, "I'm for Betty's husband for president." It was really so much about Betty Ford, and she really helped humanize Gerald Ford to a great extent.
And American politics in general. Would we could get back there soon. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week when it won't be Bastille Day for It's All Politics from NPR.
Goodbye, baby. I hope your heart's not broken. Don't forget me. Yes, I was outspoken. You were